This is Romance Watson welcoming you to another session of Software Modernization with Mark Schroeder. Today, we are speaking with Stuart Milligan, Business Development Director of Databoro. His experience includes textile engineering and development in RPG and sign-on. Stuart has extensive experience in the modernization of COBOL and RPG applications, and he has worked with IBM applications worldwide. Let's take this opportunity to learn more about software monetization using the Databoro approach. Here is your host, Mark Schroeder, as he interviews Stuart Milligan of Databoro.
We're going to talk today about software modernization using the Databoro approach. First, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about your experience with software development and modernization.
My software development career started more on the business side, in that I was an implementation and business consultant in textiles. I'm actually a textile engineer originally by profession. And I got involved in textile manufacturing and operational software and ended up working for a company that developed it, ended up becoming a developer. And then within 2 years, it was about 97, we were heavily pressed to actually modernize the technology, written in sign-on and RPG, running on an AS400 back then, about 5, 6, 7 million lines of RPG and sign-on code. So there was a heavy influence even back then. And I got more and more involved in the modernization part because of my engineering background, in the sense that you had a problem that was fundamentally technological, and an engineered approach would produce far better, more consistent, and more productive results. And that's really how I got into it. Then we got into more specifics in modernization practices, where rather than strategic modernization, such as completely refactoring or re-engineering a system, looking at tactical aspects of the technology for specific implementations. And that covered a broad set of subjects from RPG refactoring through to going from 36 to 400 modernization, database modernization, database enhancement, user interface modernization, and then refactoring overall of systems to try and make them run in a more ergonomic fashion from a development perspective, but also from an execution perspective. And that really covered a lot of different software aspects, because when you're working in an ERP situation, you have different pressures of different usability issues. And what I mean by that is that in the inquiry, sort of in management information system type mode in an ERP application, user interface and quality of data is incredibly important, and it's more user-driven. Whereas when you get into the more batch processing, where you have allocation, bill of materials, and more manufacturing-type processes, a lot of the batch logic is very, very important. And you come at when you do modernization, you come at those problems from different angles often, and they present different problems to you. I then started working with Databoro on a project, on a big installation and a modernization project I was doing in India, and it solved a big problem for us, is that we were localizing a huge ERP system for a big corporate manufacturer of textiles, vertical plant, all the way through from raw materials to finished goods, and including distribution and logistics. And Databoro helped us analyze this gargantuan application in a very, very effective and quantitative way that meant that we could take very clear and concise management decisions on exactly which parts to attack first, and also have a pretty accurate prediction on what it would take and what effort and what times would be required to do what we did. Yeah, so that's sort of it in a nutshell.
It sounds like you have extensive modernization experience, and that's a passion of yours.
Yeah, I'd say you sort of get drawn into it because it's a big challenge. You know, when you look at one program and you look at it from a programming point of view, it's interesting. But when you look at it from a system point of view, where you've got thousands of programs, millions of lines of code, you've got design of technology, you've got design of system, you've got modernization, you've got the pressures of business, you've got time, you've got people. It's an incredible challenge, and it's sort of an engineer's dream in a lot of respects, in that a lot of people don't like to work with things that exist, but I do. I like to look at re-engineering as a way of taking something that's very, very difficult and actually doing, you know, something fairly unusual with it. So yeah, it is quite a passion.
And that's a big problem right now. You know, a lot of the companies have big applications out there, and they just need to find some way to handle that and move it into a modern world.
I mean, that's it. It's the size of the problem, really, that's the big challenge. You know, that there are new technologies and new methods and new resources becoming available all the time. But essentially, it's the complexity and the dimension of companies' applications that really is the big problem. As I said, not many people are really that interested in investing a huge amount of emotional or intellectual energy in looking at an old problem. But companies have that problem.
Most of our financial transactions are still accomplished on COBOL. Those are not brand new systems anymore.
Well, you know what's interesting? I heard a Forrester research quote a couple of years ago that said on any given day, as much as 80% of any of the world's financial transactions actually takes place on a mid-range system somewhere. And the majority of that was in either RPG or COBOL.
That's sure a lot of work to do. A lot of these are IBMI shops. IBMI is a pretty strong workhorse out there. What are some of the issues that they face in modernizing their software?
I think, you know, in terms of priority, there's a lot of problems, but I think the two fundamental ones are that there's a diminishing set of resources that are available to people-wise and skill-wise to actually solve the technological problem of understanding these large complex applications sufficiently to make informed and productive enough decisions to actually take the application asset forward. The other problem is that there really is not the culture of tooling for re-engineering in the world. A lot of people looked at re-engineering back in the early 80s and the philosophy of CASE from a forward engineering perspective. A lot of people poo-pooed it because they didn't feel that it was possible to produce the optimum system. But in a modernization context, tooling becomes incredibly important. So most companies really lack resources. They've got a very large and complex problem, and generally they lack the tooling. Those are the three most important factors and the challenges that they face.
And there's a lot of information they need in order to determine how to modernize. What kind of information do they need to look at?
Well, this technology is one thing that they need, but really what they, more importantly, is they need to understand where they are. Nobody can really make an informed decision about where they want to go unless they know where they are. And that sounds like a fairly vague statement, but what I mean by that is that, you know, you cannot plot any real position and route in real predictable and risk-averse terms unless you have a very precise understanding of your exact position. And you've got to quantify that. So it's knowledge about what you've got and how much you've got and how complex it is, but also facing the reality of relevance is that a lot of the companies that I work with in installations and modernization of various projects over the last 15 years or so, many of them make assumptions about what goes on in their legacy application. And then when you run a tool like XAnalysis over it, or you do a bit of analysis work with them, you reveal things to them that they had no idea that were in their application. For example, a big batch calculation does an allocation or an invoicing calculation. You know, maybe the original programmer that wrote that just hasn't been around for 10 years and they've just relied upon that technology. And suddenly they're faced with the situation where they say, well, we want to modernize this code. So instead of looking at things in terms of bits and bytes or lines of source code and guesswork, you want to quantify that. So that's a very, very important aspect of where you should start.
This is such a complex endeavor you're working on. How can you calculate that complexity? And how does that fit into what you're gathering and the information you're getting to modernize?
There are more scientific methods of calculating a complexity, Halstead volume, cyclomatic complexity. And these mechanisms are really used to look at individual programs, if you like, and you can aggregate them over entire systems, but they look at it in a very, very scientific way. And they're probably some of the more extreme approaches to measuring complexity. They're useful and they will give you an indication. Probably more commonly used approach is to say, well, how many lines of source code have we got? How many objects have we got? And how many data files have we got? How many programs? How many display files? I think there's also another important factor that you should take into consideration, and those are relevant design constructs. And in AS400 or IBMI legacy applications, there are things such as copybooks that can contribute to the complexity, the number of subroutines, the lack of subroutines versus the number of source lines that you've got, implying that you've got an incredibly convoluted program that doesn't have any structure to it or very little structure to it, the number of indicators, right-hand indicators and left-hand indicators. These are all contributing factors. And the important thing in any complexity or subjective analysis, if you like, because complexity is a subjective calculation, even if you do it scientifically, specifically is what you're after is something that's more representative of something that you can do something with the result. In other words, when I look at complexity, such as Halstead volume, it's great to tell me that I've got a great number of complex programs, but having generic complexity knowledge is not that useful compared to, say, I've got 1,500 files, all of which need externalizing, or we need to understand the relationships. And so what you're trying to do when you use complexity calculations in a modernization context is trying to find information that more clearly represents the nature and the dimension of the problem that you've got in more sizable chunks that you can consume and then use. So in other words, you don't want to have too much detailed information. At the same time, you don't want too much guesswork. It's somewhere in the middle.
Now, IBM does help with some of that research. They have some commands such as display program references, display object description, and display file description. I assume you use these commands in your process. How do they fit in, and how do they help you map an application?
Well, the nice thing about the 400 is that it's got a lot of that type of information available to you. So at an object level, it is actually really quite significant. And one of the big advantages that companies like us and various other tool vendors have had over the years is using that. The source change management tools use it to make sure they get all the objects in, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it can only go so far, though, because dealing with things at an object level is fine, but it's a bit like trying to fix a watch with a barge pole. It's a bit rough, and it's not as accurate as you necessarily want things. One of the reasons for that is the inference of design. And what I mean by that is that the source code can infer a relationship between two objects or a variable, for example, that may be significant in business terms and design terms, but isn't obvious when you look at the object-to-file or object-to-object relationship. So those commands are very, very useful, but they have a limited amount of use if you really want to get to accurate forensics and analysis results. And just to make a point, the extrapolation of information that is fairly coarse-grained means that you have very little predictability on the probability of it being accurate. So in other words, if you're doing a proof of concept or you take a small sample of code and you say this represents things and you extrapolate it out using some linear formula, generally you're going to get it wrong. And the more granular and the more detailed basic forensics that you can use, the more accurate your result or predictable your result can be. And display program reference, display object description, and all these built-in commands are very useful up to a point, but you really need to go a lot further. And that means looking at the source code.
Looking at the source code. So you have a lot of people reading the source code, or you have a way to look through that through the programs?
Well, there's a good way to represent this. Imagine if you wanted to rediscover America. And you needed to get across America quite quickly to get a job done on California. So you arrive in Boston and you get off the ship and you say, right, let's go. So do you want to take 100 people with you that can write down notes of where they go and how they go about it and then have debates every night on exactly which way you should be going? Or do you want to sit down and say, hang on a minute, let's find a GPS or a map and find out where everything is, and then let's just drive around? I think the latter is applicable. And I think really the analogy that I'm drawing there is that if you do things manually in analysis, you will get it done and you will collate information. But a much easier way is to actually, at a more fundamental level, actually have a ready pre-built map of exactly the terrain, the geography, and the area that you're going to be transversing or you're going to be assessing. And in doing that, it means the group of people that you've got can rather deal with the results of this basic forensics and map rather than with the process of actually building the map itself.
So you build a map as one of your first steps in the whole process.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the most fundamental aspect of it, is that without the map, any subsequent analysis, as I said earlier on, becomes a lot more guesswork, and you're extrapolating out its averages of averages. And really what you want is the most detailed level of basic forensics that you can get. And based upon that, you can start making better predictions.
And once you have the map, does that go into the functional organization, or does that go into the real guts of the programs, or does it do a bit of both?
It's a bit of both. You know, that's an interesting question, because a lot of people think about application mapping and analysis tool and what some people in the industry currently call program understanding as a way of mapping an application. And it is to some degree, but it's a little bit sort of basic. It's a bit like handcrafted maps versus a real GPS. A GPS takes pictures from a satellite, and it takes them at very fixed and rigid intervals using a very, very rigid method and then calculation in order to bring all of these different grid references together. That's a very sophisticated approach. And it means that you want things at a very detailed level, but you also want them at a higher level to some degree. And building a functional map of a business application means that you've sometimes got to look at an object level, sometimes a particular piece of information that relates to a fundamental design or business rule, if you like, in the entire system, which affects a company, might be one line of code. And so you do need that map at multiple levels.
So once you've built the map at the functional level, what information does that help you provide and how does that let you proceed forward?
Once you've got this map of how every object interrelates, there is a certain amount of business design or design information that is inherent in the way that an application is architected. The entry points are usually the starting point in a business process. The user interfaces formats, for example, are usually individual steps in a business process. The text that people assign to a user interface or to a program object usually is a summarized description of the overall transaction or the process. And so there's a lot of information embedded in systems that can be used. The trick is to actually put it in a structured and cohesive map, if you like to use again, or provide it and present it to consumers. And those consumers might be analysts, they might be programmers, they might be management. You want to present it to people in such a way that they can actually understand it in context.
And I guess this map is going to go several layers down into the depths of the application. How many layers can you realistically go down and understand and present to someone?
Well, from an implementation point of view, you've got programs or objects, if you like, and data files, and you've got display files, if you like, at that level. Then you've got source code, and then you've got individual lines of source code. And one of the things that we've advanced in terms of the science of analysis over the years, which is not just us doing it, it's the industry, is concepts such as business rules. Subroutines represent usually a cyclic piece of logic that is almost self-contained and is, you know, reusable and repetitive. I mean, it's those type of design constructs that represent potentially another layer in the system, but it's not always obvious when you read a source code program because of inconsistencies of programming methods and approaches, syntax. You know, there are RPG-2 all the way through to RPG-3 in these systems, and you've had upwards of, you know, maybe 1,000 different programmers over 20 years developing a system. And so you've got to take all those idiosyncrasies away and actually then look at the layers that are in an application from a design perspective. And sometimes the objects in the source code and the source lines are relevant to that, but they've got to make sense. And so what you want to build is a structured framework, if you like, information framework that allows you then to traverse the layers effectively. And the layers can be almost infinite. It's not infinite in that it might be a call stack that goes down 14 or 15 layers, and then there may be, you know, individual programs and source lines inside of there that you've got to drill down to. But it goes all the way from the bottom upwards, from the source lines, individual source lines, all the way up to objects, and then aggregating objects together into what we call application areas, which usually represent groups or business functions. And then going downwards, it starts at the complete system, and then you can drill down all the way into, say, for example, objects. Then inside of an object, you can say, well, let's look at an individual screen format because that maps to a business process. And then let's go and look at a business rule. And then inside that business rule, let's go and look at one of the conditions. So it's multiple layers and it's from multiple perspectives.
As you're analyzing this, you have the application understood, but then you also have the database side. What aspects of the database do you have to map to understand what is involved in your database structure?
You need the physical structure, such as what the columns are, the fields. You need the files, you need the views or the logical files or the access paths, as they're sometimes referred to. And these bits of information reveal things about the system. For example, if I look at a table or a physical file and it's got a logical view built over it with a certain number of keys, it's a pretty good guess for me that someone wanted a report over that file based upon those keys. And then if I look at the nature of those keys, such as it happens to be customer and order, I know that generally this company that uses this application manages their business by looking at their customers' orders by customer, for example. And so the database can actually reveal that. The other very, very important part is the relational information, the foreign key information. So when a customer owns an order file, what is the foreign key relationship between those two, which enables me then to actually build program constructs that enable me to navigate it for update purposes, for interrogation, for building business intelligence cubes and the various other things that you want to build around an application database. So the important factor, just to summarize then, is not just the physical attributes, but the logical attributes, which is the foreign key relationships.
One of the ways that you do this is by looking at the DDS. What kind of information do you extract out of the DDS, and what kind of diagrams do you create with that?
From the DDS, you can get a certain amount, but in RPG-based systems, by design, most of the field names are different, so the RPG can handle it. And that means that by just looking at the field, it's not explicit that there is a foreign key between two files, for example. Usually it's a prefix. So in other words, the last four digits of the six-digit field will be the same between the files, but the first digits may vary. But on big systems, that you get a roll around. In other words, they run out of field names, and so that becomes irrelevant as well. And so from the DDS, you can get a certain amount, but then you need to get into the RPG code or the COBOL code, because the implementation of the referential integrity in almost every single IBMI, RPG or COBOL system in the world is implemented in the actual program code itself. So what you really need to do is read the RPG or the COBOL code to derive those foreign key relationships.
You have to have that combination, and the DDS itself then can't be directly converted into SQL, but you have to use a combination of analysis, if I understand right.
Well, you can actually convert DDS to SQL without any problem, but the result that it produces is limited by what you put in. And DDS has a limit on what it has in it. It doesn't have the referential integrity. And also, the tooling that's provided doesn't really allow you to view the foreign key relationships because they aren't explicitly defined. So one of the points that you asked that I didn't actually answer was what diagrammatic constructs. Entity relationship diagrams are one of the fundamental tools that any business intelligence consultant will actually use in order to build a data warehouse. For an analyst to understand how a business application works, if it's a database-driven application, which almost every single business application is, the main part of the architecture, 80%, if you like, of contribution of the actual business architecture is in the data model itself. So entity relationship diagrams, class diagrams, and diagrams that explain the database structure are very, very important. And so taking it from DDS to SQL, you can do it, but you want to enrich that with other information, such as long field names and things like that.
You would include your data model and your DDS together to convert to SQL?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we do. So you end up with an incredibly rich application database architecture.
Application like 2E, I do quite a bit of development in that, and the names for your fields and files, they're so cryptic. It's nice to be able to move to something that actually means something.
Well, you know what's interesting on the subject of 2E and modernization, quite a few of our customers are actually rebuilding their underlying databases using our tooling by extracting the information from the 2E model and generating DDL from that.
And then they take the DDL and that goes directly into what format?
You just run it as a script. You can run it in almost any database management system. You can run it in MSQL, on Oracle, MySQL. You just run the DDLs. Because DDL is actually data definition language, and it is SQL code. And it's the implementation, how you implement the actual structures, the schemas themselves. And so you run it in the script engine of the database management system that you're using or any other available tool, and it will actually create the physical database for you. So, of course, if you're enriching your DDL code or the SQL code, if you like, with all of this inferred design information that you've gleaned from the RPG or COBOL code or the sign-on model, you end up with very, very well-articulated database as a result.
We've talked about the application map. We've talked about creating the SQL. The application map, it can be used as an input into your re-engineering. How does this fit? What do you do once you have your application map?
You've got to sort of break it down into further constructs, because modern applications really use what you might call model-based programming. And what I mean by that is not using a model to generate the code, but I mean that it goes to a pattern. A model view controller, for example, is generally industry standard or sub-patterns from that, maybe model and view and maybe controller and model in a batch type application. application, a web service-based application. And so what you're looking to do with the application map is to abstract some of the detailed information up higher. So you end up with constructs such as a data model or an object relational map, which brings together an object relational map is a way of translating a database, a relational database, into an object-oriented style architecture. So modern object-oriented programmers and technologies can consume the data from there in a way that is more suitable for the object-oriented approach to development. And so that's one of the inputs. So in other words, the data model, relational model, is the fundamental way of actually mapping an object relational map. You then combine that with the information about how those entities or those physical files and views are used in a given program, which you could call a transaction, for example. You then can build an object relational map that has a transaction dimension to it, if you like. So in other words, you know where the data for a given transaction, say an order entry program, you know where the data comes from, you know how it relates, you know all the join rules to actually build the different views. And you can build the object relational map in a product like Hibernate, for example, or other modern industry standards like NHibernate, which is the porting of Hibernate to C#. And with these, what they call persistence frameworks, it makes the development process much easier. So in terms of taking that concept further, you could then say, well, if I've got this explicitly defined set of DDL that we spoke about a moment ago, and I can generate the database, can I use DDL to actually build an object relational map in a modern application framework like Hibernate? And the answer is yes. You can import it directly. So you can create the entire Java Persistent API framework and all the classes and all the configuration files just by importing the DDL. So it's a nice stage. That's a simple example of how it can be used. You can take it a step further and say, okay, in my legacy application that I'm trying to modernize, one of the other critical elements that is of interest to me is all these business rules that I've been programming for the last 20 to 30 years. They really represent how my business has evolved and how we've learned to do things more cleverly. And it's almost a software implemented version of my business specification, if you like. The problem is it's all spread around your system. It's buried inside of RPG, maybe CL, maybe COBOL code, inside of sign-on action diagrams. So what you want to do is distill that out into a form of business rules database, but keep the context, because the context is important. It's pointless doing a price calculation if you're not putting an order in. For example. So it's bringing that application map together with modern constructs. So you're bringing business rules together with the context of a particular transaction, say an order entry. And then if you can distill that via the application map, which knows where all these components are, in such a way that you can then put it into a new tool or put it into the mind of a new developer through some descriptive process, a picture of a data model, a class diagram, an activity diagram, a narrative that describes what the RPG code is doing, a picture and a narrative of exactly what the action diagram is doing for that given user interface that it's going to be used for in a modern application against the database that we've modernized now and put on MySQL or just put a new version of on the IBM i. So bringing those constructs together, you can then generate the code to build the application framework from it. The last bit that I'll just mention is that the user interface information is also very important. The problem that you have with legacy applications from 2E all the way through RPG COBOL is that it's procedural, and modern development requires event-driven architecture. That's what Model View Controller actually is. In other words, the user interface, from some interaction with the user, either pressing a tab button or selecting a key or something like that, will actually go away and actually fire off an event, which then might execute some piece of business logic. The user interface information, because it is driven by a procedural program, is actually quite difficult to get out and restructure. But if you can distill the user interface information into a form of metadata and describe it, it means that you've actually got a very, very powerful bit of information that can be used to generate the skeleton. But at a more fundamental level, in terms of what I would call conservative modernization, where you want to keep your application in RPG or COBOL, then what you would do is you can use some more fundamental constructs such as subroutines. You can externalize your subroutines and generate procedures and modules and then replace the execute subroutine statements in your original program with calls to these procedures. Then you can build simple stub programs, if you like, that then attach to the individual procedures in the modules, and you can create a web service that then exposes all of those subroutines and those new procedures, or sub-procedures, if you like, as a form of web service. And that means you've deconstructed the application, and you've done all of this by analyzing the application model, seeing where you've got the subroutines, understanding their context, looking at the business rule, and then re-architecting using the analysis information that you had.
That initial analysis you just mentioned really opens up a lot of open doors for you as far as which direction you want to go from that point forward.
Absolutely. It's quantitative, isn't it? It's once you know where you are and you understand the value and the relevance, you can't ask a business user how important the tax calculation is unless you know what the tax calculation is.
One of the things that we do in programming and in engineering is we look back at time, and we've learned some things from one of the events we call Y2K. What kind of things do you find relevant now for modernization that we learned back in those days?
Interestingly, it's almost the same problem in a way. It depends what you mean by modernization. Completely rebuilding a system is an incredibly complicated and big task. In a more conservative context, such as something simple, that you get a new standard, a regulatory compliance requirement that dictates that you've got to expand a field. Now, that's a modernization project, and it can sometimes cripple a company for the simple reason that if I've got, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 programs and I've got to expand my product code for, you know, internationalization or some regulatory requirement, it might take me a couple of years to get through the coding just to make that simple change. And that's very analogous to what happened with Y2K. You had a relatively simple problem that manifests itself in a very, very large way. And so what we learned from Y2K, which was, you know, great for us as a company, is that the majority of companies just weren't prepared. And what they weren't prepared for is understanding the scope of the problem that they had, and thereafter being able to technologically fix that problem. And that's exactly what we did. You know, in having a technology that builds an incredibly detailed application map, sort of a compiler for an entire system, if you like, with all of the ability to drill down and have all the information at your fingertips, it's quite straightforward then to write algorithms that can programmatically change the system. And that's what we learned from Y2K, the fact that people weren't prepared, that they didn't think that they had that much of an analysis problem until they were confronted with something so significant as Y2K. And you see this on a more regular basis. So if you then interpolate that, if you like, or retrofit it into the modernization question, when someone says, well, how much or how long will it take to refactor this system to make it, you know, that I can build a modern interface over it? And people do the same sort of guesswork they were doing back in Y2K. When people look at a problem with a database change, they'll say, well, I've done the display program reference and I think that's enough. And they've missed, you know, all of the subtle inferences that might have made the project 10 times bigger. And so they overrun by 10 times the amount of time.
And a lot of companies, they're still approaching re-engineering in a manual approach. What are the steps that are involved in the manual approach?
Well, if you compare the two different approaches, it's sometimes easy to show this in a picture. But if you imagine the way that a programmer works is that they have a set of ideas of what they want to do, and then they attack one program at a time and fix that program and go down until they fixed all the problems in that particular program, test it, and move on to the next one. But when you compare that to a re-engineering approach, what you do is you find out all the problems, and then you look at them across all the systems and all the programs that you've got, the individual. You then break those programs down into type, or the problems, sorry, down into types, and then you go and you change one problem at a time across all programs. The manual approach generally means that you're doing one program at a time, and it can produce a lot of problems, but that's generally the way that people do it, is they have a general brief on what they want to find, they go ahead and they fix the program one at a time, and then they go forward from there.
What kind of problems can the manual approach present to the company?
Well, human error is the most obvious one. It's very time-consuming. I mean, a factory that manufactures cars is productive because they mass produce individual components one at a time. So the concept of automated re-engineering is not a new one. And why should the software industry be any different? Because people want to be creative, because they want to finish one because it's a personal preference? No, it's a commodity. You need to be productive. You need to get the job done. The company needs the result. And so why not apply engineering principles to these changes? And that's the most important problem you have with manual changes is the time constraints. The human errors are introduced. The other problem that you've got is that you may take a particular approach and you may get halfway through and then someone comes up with a better idea or they face a particular problem that actually could manifest itself in the programs that have already been done and you can't start all over again. So it means that you work in working in a linear way, you have to stay in a linear way. So it means that you can't repeat things and you can't do them iteratively.
What are the benefits you get from an automated approach? And how does it solve these problems?
Well, you can do things again and again. You simplify each and every problem that you've got in a very straightforward fashion. Because you're doing it in a very scientific and engineered approach, it means the way that you quantify both how long it might take and what effort it might require, it means that you can have a much higher degree of predictability. And because you're automating it, it means that you need less people. It means the result can be more consistent. You have to test less. A lot of people don't realize that they think, oh, if you get it wrong, then it's wrong everywhere, and how can we be confident? But if you get it right once in one place, then everywhere is correct, so you have to test less. That's another important factor. And the bottom line just goes down to cost. If you can get a program to do something, that's the whole reason information systems exist. It's a lot cheaper than getting a human to do it.
Cost is really an important part in every company.
That's it. I mean, a lot of people aren't comfortable with upfront cost because they feel that if you do things gradually and you just consume salaries of people that are employed anyway, and a lot of companies manage their business on that basis, is that it's just it's not a direct cost that doesn't go on the balance sheet. It's just an indirect overhead from a salary that's been paid. But the bit that they miss is those people could be used to actually do a lot more productive and more innovative things.
Exactly. They know the business already, so let them produce better software for their business instead of rewriting all the old stuff.
Well, that's right. I mean, how often do you go into an IT department, especially in the S400 world, and somebody's doing something that they think is a technical junket, if you like, and their in-tray is piled high with requests for reports that the users want?
Right. Very often. Yep.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier a modernization task of resizing the field. How can you determine what scope this project would take?
One of the problems that you have in any integrated large complex system is that you have to trace the impact right down to a variable level. And so when you establish the scope, you can't just do it at an object level. You've actually got to go down into where, for example, if I am trying to change the customer number and the customer number is then used to chain off to another file to go and read the orders, for example, and then that's used to go away and actually build some statistics in another file. And you think, well, I'm only changing the customer file, but suddenly you've got to change the orders file. Then you've got to change the statistics file. These fields may have a different name. And once you change the statistics file, you've got to change all the order statistics programs that read it. And so it's very difficult. That's just at a file level. And what about the variables that it uses? Imagine you've got a batch program that's doing some sort of statistical calculation or tax calculation based upon the value of order lines, and you change the price field, for example. All that calculation, all those arrays, all those variables are actually also not going to work. So it's like, in a way, it's a bit like Y2K all over again. In fact, that's exactly what it is. And so if you have an application map, and when I say an application map, I'm not talking about something from the stratosphere. This is where you look at the application map at the most detailed possible level, which is the variable-to-variable relationship in context. So I know that the relationship between that variable and that variable is of this nature. It's an update, it's a move, whatever it might be. It's a definition. If you've got that type of map instantly available in a structured format, it means that when you ask this application map a question about the scope of a problem, like a database change, it can go across the entire system and literally come back in seconds. I mean, I've had instances where I've done projects with people where they ask me the question, you know, when we install our products, and somebody says, well, how would I do this? We've just finished this exercise even with an older cross-referencing tool, and it took us 4 weeks. And we do it literally in 11 seconds in our product because the application map has got it available there. You've got all the information at your fingertips. It's a bit like Google Earth. How do I get there? What's down there? Where's the car park? You can press the button, zoom in, you know where it is, you jump in your car and off you go.
That saves a lot of time then, because if someone was going to look at all that manually, they'd spend hours and hours and never finish it. So, and your tool is able to do that kind of cross-referencing.
Well, that's what the application map is used for. And then we've written inquiries over this application map. So the sort of the scientific approach, if you like, of what we do is broken up into two main sort of sections. One is building the application map, and that means reading RPG and COBOL and sign-on systems at a very, very detailed and comprehensive way, and understanding the subtle inferences that is meant by compute statements and action diagrams and foreign keys and primary keys and all that sort of stuff, putting it in the map. And then the other thing that we do is write technologies that then use that to build reports, to re-engineer systems, to tell you where things are, to draw color-coded interactive diagrammatic pictures of the architecture of a series of programs. Yeah, and that's how we bring that actually together.
And then with that information, then you have enough information to write a program that actually does the work for you. Is that right?
Absolutely. Remember, I said a moment ago that in an assembly line in a car manufacturer, you make all the wheels in one part of the factory. You make all the cylinder heads in another part of the factory, and then you assemble them in another one. Well, we take the concept of knowing what the change is in very clearly articulated terms. We understand by virtue of the application map exactly what that means at every single line in every single program across the entire system. It's very easy then to write simple programs that go and do simple changes at that level across all the programs one at a time. When I say all the programs one at a time, I meant one type of problem fixed across all programs one at a time. And then what you're left with is just measuring and reporting where you've got exceptions where you might have a problem. That's the concept of writing reengineering technologies.
Sounds like it would save a lot of time for a lot of companies to use some of these products.
It's interesting is that once I think people have used an application map approach down to the level of detail that we're talking about, you never turn back. If you look at all the case studies that we've got on our website, just speak to any one of our customers and they're like, wow, I wish I had this 6 years ago. You know, it's just such a fundamental. I mean, imagine living without a GPS, without a map. Imagine an airplane flying without a GPS system.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't do it.
And, you know, as you go forward and continue to add to your application, having this map is just going to help you understand the application better.
Well, that's right. You know, there's an important part looking at the reverse of that is that, you know, with the diminishing set of resources and a lot of companies looking to offshore to actually reduce costs, you increase risk. You increase risk because you've got less resources to do more things because you've got more code, because every year you're writing more code and you're making enhancements. The minute you go offshore, you're saying, well, I'm giving up my application knowledge base because these people don't know my application. But if you've got an application map that can give someone that hasn't seen the system before very detailed and very clearly concise graphic color-coded information about the design of an application instantly as it currently stands, it means that you've solved that problem too.
Another area of modernization is going to Unicode. That's something new out there that a lot of companies are having to go to. Is Unicode pretty much the same as modifying a field? Or are there other steps that are involved with that?
It's almost identical, actually. You know, it was interesting. We have, you know, one technology, the X-Resize component, which was sort of a descendant, if you like, of our year 2000 product that we had. And Unicode was spawned out of X-Resize, too. And it's just another form of it, because what you're looking to do is add the necessary code to the database itself, and then you're looking for the display files and wherever it might be relevant in a program to actually update the necessary CCSID codes in there too. And so what you're looking at in more simplistic pure engineering terms is you're looking to do a bit of intelligent search and replace. That intelligent part is the important part. That's why you can't use a normal sort of text or any of the, you know, current sort of RPG code editors to do it, because to do it across the entire system, it has to understand context and more precisely what you need to change. But essentially, it's the same principle as field expansion or Y2K.
All right. Well, you have a certain set of tools at DataBurrow that help companies modernize. Can you give me a little overview? You know, we've talked about them already throughout this discussion, but how your tools help with defining, building, and implementing a good modernization approach?
I think the two sort of aspects, the way to represent the technology is in two sort of ways. One is active and the other one is passive. The most common use of our products over many, many years has been the passive use, and that's the analytical aspect. In other words, building a very, very structured map and then allowing people to go in and actually map their business to it. So you're doing what I call a top-down analysis and mapping it with the bottom-up. And so X-Analysis, which is our flagship product, has been around for 23, 24 years. is really what does that. It's something that builds the application map, and then it gives you client-based tools that enable you then to go and draw pictures, instant documentation, look at business rules in structured English, see pictures of structure charts, data flow chart, entity relationship diagrams, and all that. And so you've got this incredibly powerful, and it is a bit like a GPS. Imagine that the repository that we build over the business system that we're analyzing is pre-built, it's ready to use, and that's the information that a GPS would use, for example. And then XAnalysis, the client, enables you to then drill down and look at this interactively and navigate your way around it, or produce reports that show you the completeness of structure. In other words, all of the changes that need to be made, all of the data modeling relationships, all of the user interface formats and their structure, the structure of programs, where an object is used, and all that sort of classic sort of stuff in an interactive and graphical way. And just another point to make that a lot of people miss the relevance of, color coding is a very, very important aspect in anybody's life. Our brain responds to color before it actually understands what the eye is actually seeing. So before your brain can conceive what object it's actually looking at, your brain will already respond to the color that it sees. So having graphical documentation over a large complex application can mean that you can assimilate architectural information that helps you decide on a modernization strategy in terms of what does this program do? Is it relevant? What is the underlying architecture? How is this code written? All of that information is much easier assimilated by looking at it graphically in color coding. In terms of the active side of our business, that's using incredibly detailed application map in an active context to do things like converting the database from DDS to SQL. We can do that literally, you know, over a weekend for very, very large complicated systems, and you don't have to recompile a single RPG program. This is not rocket science in the sense that if you read the IBM Red Book, it tells you you can do that. But because you've got large complex systems, and because we subtly bring all the information about the system together and we automate what is essentially quite a simple process, but because the systems are large, because they're complicated, because there's quite a few gotchas in such a process, it means using an automated tool you get less risk, you get higher level of automation, you've got less testing requirement, and you've got high levels of confidence. And that's how we can use our tools actively, including things like the field expansion, where we can take a field and expand it and automate it across the entire system and literally save companies millions of dollars. I'm only the one case study that we've got at the moment. Company used the product last year. The previous year, they did a field expansion project, and they reckon it saved them at least 13 to 15 man years of work by using our technology to do it.
Wow, sounds like your tool paid for itself there over again many times.
Yeah, I think we should ask for a higher price.
Right. Aside from your tools, you know, when someone comes and becomes a customer of yours, what kind of support do you provide them?
There's two parts. Is that, you know, this is really an engineered and a scientific approach to software maintenance and modernization. And a lot of people aren't that familiar with using tools, power tools like this, in their own context. It's not proprietary technology or proprietary methods we're trying to teach people. We can help people understand how to utilize the tools by getting them involved with using the technology more effectively. And we do that through basic training. Another thing that we do is that on many customer systems, there are idiosyncrasies with some of the coding constructs that are just unusual. You know, COBOL is more typical of this, but often in RPG we find that too. And we have a very, very good reputation for looking at systems and coming up with workarounds and fixes and enhancements to our own product set that make it really work as productively as any system on using our products without any real glitch. And we've got a fantastic reputation for that. The last thing that we're actually very good at is that if a company gives us their system, because we've been analyzing systems, literally thousands of them, of must be trillions of lines of code over many, many, many years, and we're able to look at systems and come up with pretty good code review and assessments on tactical approaches and even strategic approaches on how they can modernize their code, re-engineer their system, and but also in terms of how to use the product to map the relevance of the software that they've got to their business process. And what I mean by that is that when a company is looking at their business and saying, well, what are my business requirements? And then turning around and saying, well, what does the software currently do and how does it map to that? We can help them with that process too.
So in the process of their modernization, they could actually end up with a lot better business logic and business application than they had before.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole point, is that you don't want to do things that are unnecessary, but you don't want to over-engineer what you're trying to achieve as well. Often what happens because people do things one at a time is they tend to, and when I use the term over-engineer, what I mean is trying to perfect what they're trying to do in one hit. Now, that's a typical technological approach, but if you take an engineered approach, what you're trying to do is actually get the low-hanging fruit. So you get as much modernization done for as little effort as possible, and therefore get the maximum gain in the shortest amount of time. And that's what we're very good at. We've got people in our organization that have done huge re-engineering projects that we've productized often, but sometimes we've done with our products and haven't productized some of the processes. And that expertise is quite unique. And I think it's something that companies value, especially in the context of a very large, complicated application with potentially millions and millions of lines of code that they've got to do something significant with in terms of a change. And so to come up with a quantified, intelligent re-engineering approach is really, really worth its weight in gold for a lot of people.
Now, when they're re-engineering, is there a target language that you make them go to, or can they use any of the acceptable modern languages at this time?
Anything that they're really interested in. One of the things that's very important to us and always has been is that we follow mainstream. We can't and don't want to build anything that's proprietary because the industry that we work in, AS/400 world, now moving into mid-range systems, if you like, in VB and Java, but really it's about AS/400 application code. People are looking for industry standard technologies. And so if you've got an application map, if you've got business rules database, if you've got an entity relationship diagram, if you've got a DDL, if you've got a class diagram, if you've got an activity diagram, it's got to be presented and communicated and utilized in such a way that you can generate anything out of it. Otherwise, we would have a very limited use for people.
Sounds good. It really provides customers some good flexibility then.
Absolutely. It's just a great foundation and a way to start. The foundation product, the passive use of XAnalysis, and getting a very clear picture of your data model, your business rules, the user interface, or what you might call the process logic from a user perspective of your system is an incredibly important piece of information to quantify and have an accurate picture of before you do any modernization.
Now that people are all ready to go and buy your product, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Probably through our website. We have various partners around the world, a number in the US, IBM. There are a number of IBM experts. IBM Rochester have copies of our product. Various ISVs have a copy of our product and actually support some of their customers with our product. But the easiest way is just to contact us directly through the website, www.databro.com, and then just look for someone in your region or contact us directly.
Stuart, thank you for your time. I enjoyed the conversation and learned a lot, and I look forward to following your product and seeing how it can increase companies and their modernization approach.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for another session of Software Modernization. Please be sure to check back often on our website to find more interviews and additional resources. Our goal is to build a warehouse of information on software application modernization. For more information on software modernization and how you can subscribe to our free services, please visit us at www.softwaremodernization.com. We are always looking for experts in software modernization who are interested in sharing knowledge on this subject. If you are an expert and want to be interviewed by Mark Schroeder, please visit softwaremonetization.com and click on the interview link. This has been a production of MAT, Marketing Assistance Technologies.